The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie. Chapter 28. Extract from the Diary of Sir Eustace Pedlar. As I remarked once before, I'm essentially a man of peace. I yearn for a quiet life, and that's just the one thing I don't seem able to have. I'm always in the middle of storms and alarms. The relief of getting away from Paget with his incessant nosing out of intrigues was enormous, and Miss Pettigrew is certainly a useful creature. Although there's nothing of the houri about her, one or two of her accomplishments are invaluable. It's true that I had a touch of liver at Bulawayo and behaved like a bear in consequence, but I had had a disturbed night in the train. At 3 a.m., an exquisitely dressed young man, looking like a musical comedy hero of the Wild West, entered my compartment and asked where I was going. Disregarding my first murmur of tea, and for God's sake, don't put sugar in it, he repeated his question, laying stress on the fact that he was not a waiter, but an immigration officer. I finally succeeded in satisfying him that I was suffering from no infectious disease, that I was visiting Rhodesia from the purest of motives, and further gratified him with my full Christian names and my place of birth. I then endeavored to snatch a little sleep, but some officious ass aroused me at 5:30 with a cup of liquid sugar, which he called tea. I don't think I threw it at him, but I know that that was what I wanted to do. He brought me unsugared tea, stone cold, at 6, and I then fell asleep utterly exhausted to awaken just outside Bulawayo and be landed with a beastly wooden giraffe, all legs and neck. But for these small contretemps, all had been going smoothly. And then, fresh calamity befell. It was the night of our arrival at the falls. I was dictating to Miss Pettigrew in my sitting room, when suddenly Mrs. Blair burst in without a word of excuse and wearing most compromising attire. "Where's Anne?" she cried. A nice question to ask, as though I were responsible for the girl. What did she expect Miss Pettigrew to think? That I was in the habit of producing Anne Bedingfield from my pocket at midnight or thereabouts? Very compromising for a man in my position. "I presume," I said coldly, "that she is in her bed." I cleared my throat and glanced at Miss Pettigrew to show that I was ready to resume dictating. I hoped Mrs. Blair would take the hint. She did nothing of the kind. Instead, she sank into a chair and waved a slippered foot in an agitated manner. "She's not in her room. I've been there. I had a dream, a terrible dream, that she was in some awful danger, and I got up and went to her room just to reassure myself, you know. She wasn't there, and her bed hadn't been slept in." She looked at me appealingly. "What shall I do, Sir Eustace?" Repressing the desire to reply, "Go to bed and don't worry over nothing. An able-bodied young woman like Anne Bedingfield is perfectly well able to take care of herself," I frowned judiciously. "What does Race say about it?" "Why should Race have it all his own way? Let him have some of the disadvantages as well as the advantages of female society. I can't find him anywhere." She was evidently making a night of it. I sighed and sat down in a chair. "I don't quite see the reason for your agitation," I said patiently. "My dream, that curry we had for dinner." "Oh, Sir Eustace." The woman was quite indignant. And yet everybody knows that nightmares are a direct result of injudicious eating. "After all," I continued persuasively, "why shouldn't Anne Bedingfield and Race go out for a little stroll without having the whole hotel aroused about it?" "You think they've just gone out for a stroll together? But it's after midnight." "One does these foolish things when one is young," I murmured, "though Race is certainly old enough to know better." "Do you really think so?" "I dare say they've run away to make a match of it," I continued soothingly, though fully aware that I was making an idiotic suggestion. "For after all, at a place like this, where is there to run away to?" I don't know how much longer I should have gone on making feeble remarks, but at that moment, Race himself walked in upon us. At any rate, I'd been partly right. He had been out for a stroll, but he hadn't taken Anne with him. However, I'd been quite wrong in my way of dealing with the situation. I was soon shown that. Race had the whole hotel turned upside down in 3 minutes. I've never seen a man more upset. The thing is very extraordinary. Where did the girl go? She walked out of the hotel, fully dressed, about 10 minutes past 11, and she was never seen again. The idea of suicide seems impossible. She was one of those energetic young women who are in love with life and have not the faintest intention of quitting it. There was no train either way until midday on the morrow, so she can't have left the place. Then, where the devil is she? Race is almost beside himself, poor fellow. He has left no stone unturned. All the DCs, or whatever they call themselves, for hundreds of miles have been pressed into service. The native trackers have run about on all fours. Everything that can be done is being done. But no sign of Anne Benningfeld. The accepted theory is that she walked in her sleep. There are signs on the path near the bridge which seem to show that the girl walked deliberately off the edge. If so, of course, she must have been dashed to pieces on the rocks below. Unfortunately, most of the footprints were obliterated by a party of tourists who chose to walk that way early on the Monday morning. I don't know that it's a very satisfactory theory. In my young days, I always was told that sleepwalkers couldn't hurt themselves, that their own sixth sense took care of them. I don't think the theory satisfies Mrs. Blair either. I can't make that woman out. Her whole attitude towards Race has changed. She watches him now like a cat a mouse, and she makes obvious efforts to bring herself to be civil to him. And they used to be such friends. Altogether, she's unlike herself, nervous, hysterical, starting and jumping at the least sound. I'm beginning to think that it's high time I went to Joburg. A rumor came along yesterday of a mysterious island somewhere up the river, with a man and a girl on it. Race got very excited. It turned out to be all a mare's nest, however. The man had been there for years, and is well known to the manager of the hotel. He totes parties up and down the river in the season, and points out crocodiles and a stray hippopotamus or so to them. I believe that he keeps a tame one, which is trained to bite pieces out of the boat on occasions. Then he fends it off with a boat hook, and the party feel that they've really got to the back of beyond at last. How long the girl has been there is not definitely known, but it seems pretty clear that she can't be Anne, and there is a certain delicacy in interfering in other people's affairs. If I were this young fellow, I should certainly kick Race off the island if he came asking questions about my love affairs. Later. It's definitely settled that I go to Joburg tomorrow. Race urges me to do so. Things are getting unpleasant there, by all I hear, but I might as well go before they get worse. I dare say I shall be shot by a striker anyway. Mrs. Blair was to have accompanied me, but at the last minute she changed her mind and decided to stay on at the falls. It seems as though she couldn't bear to take her eyes off Race. She came to me tonight and said, with some hesitation, that she had a favor to ask. Would I take charge of her souvenirs for her? Not the animals, I asked in lively alarm. I always felt that I should get stuck with those beastly animals sooner or later. In the end, we effected a compromise. I took charge of the 2 small wooden boxes for her, which contained fragile articles. The animals are to be packed by the local store in vast crates and sent to Cape Town by rail, where Paget will see to their being stored. The people who are packing them say that they are of a particularly awkward shape and that special cases will have to be made. I pointed out to Mrs. Blair that by the time she's got them home, those animals will have cost her easily £1 apiece. Paget is straining at the leash to rejoin me in Joburg. I shall make an excuse of Mrs. Blair's cases to keep him in Cape Town. I've written him that he must receive the cases and see to their safe disposal, as they contain rare curios of immense value. So all is settled, and I and Miss Pettigrew go off into the blue together. And anyone who's seen Miss Pettigrew will admit that it is perfectly respectable. Chapter 29. Johannesburg, March 6th. There's something about the state of things here that is not at all healthy. To use the well-known phrase that I have so often read, we are all living on the edge of a volcano. Bands of strikers, or so-called strikers, patrol the streets and scowl at one in a murderous fashion. They're picking out the bloated capitalists, ready for when the massacres begin, I suppose. You can't ride in a taxi. If you do, strikers pull you out again. And the hotels hint pleasantly that when the food gives out, they'll fling you out on the mat. I met Reeves, my labor friend of the Kilmorden, last night. He has cold feet worse than any man I ever saw. He's like all the rest of these people. They make inflammatory speeches of enormous length, solely for political purposes, and then wish they hadn't. He's busy now going about and saying he didn't really do it. When I met him, he was just off to Cape Town, where he mediates making a 3 days speech in Dutch, vindicates himself, and pointing out that the things he said really meant something entirely different. I'm thankful that I did not have to sit in the Legislative Assembly of South Africa. The House of Commons is bad enough, but at least we have only one language, and some slight restriction as to the length of speeches. When I went to the Assembly before leaving Cape Town, I listened to a gray-haired gentleman with a drooping mustache who looked exactly like the Mock Turtle in Alice in Wonderland. He dropped out his words one by one in a particularly melancholy fashion. Every now and then, he galvanized himself to further efforts by ejaculating something that sounded like plat skeet, uttered fortissimo, and in marked contrast to the rest of his delivery. When he did this, half his audience yelled woof, woof, which is possibly Dutch for hear, hear, and the other half woke up with a start from the pleasant nap they'd been having. I was given to understand that the gentleman had been speaking for at least 3 days. They must have a lot of patience in South Africa. I have invented endless jobs to keep Paget in Cape Town. But at last the fertility of my imagination has given out, and he joins me tomorrow in the spirit of the faithful dog who comes to die by his master's side. And I was getting on so well with my reminiscences, too. I had invented some extraordinarily witty things that the strike leaders said to me, and I said to the strike leaders. This morning I was interviewed by a government official. He was urbane, persuasive, and mysterious in turn. To begin with, he alluded to my exalted position and importance and suggested that I should remove myself, or be removed by him, to Pretoria. "You expect trouble, then?" I asked. His reply was so worded as to have no meaning whatsoever, so I gathered that they were expecting serious trouble. I suggested to him that his government were letting things go rather far. "There is such a thing as giving a man enough rope and letting him hang himself, Sir Eustace." "Oh, quite so, quite so. It's not the strikers themselves who are causing the trouble. There's some organization at work behind them. Arms and explosives have been pouring in, and we've made a haul of certain documents which throw a good deal of light on the methods adopted to import them. There's a regular code. Potatoes mean detonators. Cauliflower, rifles. Other vegetables stand for various explosives." "That's very interesting," I commended. "More than that, Sir Eustace, we have every reason to believe that the man who runs the whole show, the directing genius of the affair, is at this minute in Johannesburg." He stared at me so hard that I began to fear that he suspected me of being the man. I broke out into a cold perspiration at the thought, and began to regret that I had ever conceived the idea of inspecting a miniature revolution at first hand. "No trains are running from Joburg to Pretoria," he continued, "but I can arrange to send you over by private car. In case you should be stopped on the way, I can provide you with two separate passes, one issued by the Union government, and the other stating that you are an English visitor who has nothing whatsoever to do with the Union. One for your people, and one for the strikers, eh?" "Exactly." The project did not appeal to me. I know what happens in a case of that kind. You get flustered and mix the things up. I should hand the wrong pass to the wrong person, and it would end in my being summarily shot by a bloodthirsty rebel or one of the supporters of law and order, who I notice guarding the streets wearing bowler hats and smoking pipes, with rifles tucked carelessly under their arms. Besides, what should I do with myself in Pretoria? Admire the architecture of the Union buildings and listen to the echoes of the shooting round Johannesburg? I should be penned up there God knows how long. They've blown up the railway line already, I hear. It isn't even as if one could get a drink there. They put the place under martial law 2 days ago. "My dear fellow," I said, "you don't seem to realize that I'm studying conditions on the Rand. How the devil am I going to study them from Pretoria? I appreciate your care for my safety, but don't you worry about me. I shall be all right. I warn you, Sir Eustace, that the food question is already serious." "A little fasting will improve my figure," I said with a sigh. We were interrupted by a telegram being handed to me. I read it with amazement. "Anne is safe. Here with me at Kimberley. Suzanne Blair." I don't think I ever really believed in the annihilation of Anne. There's something peculiarly indestructible about that woman. She's like the patent balls that one gives to terriers. She has an extraordinary knack of turning up, smiling. I still don't see why it was necessary for her to walk out of the hotel in the middle of the night in order to get to Kimberley. There was no train anyway. She must have put on a pair of angel's wings and flown there. And I don't suppose she will ever explain. Nobody does, to me. I always have to guess. It becomes monotonous after a while. The exigencies of journalism are at the bottom of it, I suppose. "How I Shot the Rapids," by our special correspondent. I refolded the telegram and got rid of my government friend. I don't like the prospect of being hungry, but I'm not alarmed for my personal safety. Smuts is perfectly capable of dealing with the revolution, but I would give a considerable sum of money for a drink. I wonder if Paget will have the sense to bring a bottle of whiskey with him when he arrives tomorrow. I put on my hat and went out, intending to buy a few souvenirs. The curio shops in Joburg are rather pleasant. I was just studying a window full of imposing carosses when a man coming out of the shop cannoned into me. To my surprise, it turned out to be Race. I can't flatter myself that he looked pleased to see me. As a matter of fact, he looked distinctly annoyed, but I insisted on his accompanying me back to the hotel. I get tired of having no one but Miss Pettigrew to talk to. "I had no idea you were in Joburg," I said chattily. "When did you arrive?" "Last night." "Where are you staying?" "With friends." He was disposed to be extraordinarily taciturn and seemed to be embarrassed by my questions. "I hope they keep poultry," I remarked. "A diet of new-laid eggs and the occasional slaughtering of an old cock will be decidedly agreeable soon from all I hear. By the way," I said, when we were back in the hotel, "have you heard that Miss Bedingfeld is alive and kicking?" He nodded. "She gave us quite a fright," I said airily. "Where the devil did she go to that night? That's what I'd like to know." "She was on the island all the time." "Which island? Not the one with the young man on it?" "Yes." "How very improper," I said. "Paget will be quite shocked. He always did disapprove of Anne Bedingfeld. I suppose that was the young man she originally intended to meet in Durban." I don't think so. Don't tell me anything you don't want to, I said, by way of encouraging him. I fancy that this is a young man we should all be very glad to lay our hands on. Not, I cried in rising excitement. He nodded. Harry Rayburn, alias Harry Lucas. That's his real name, you know. He's given us all the slip once more, but we're bound to rope him in soon. Dear me, I murmured. We don't suspect the girl of complicity in any case. On her side, it's just a love affair. I always did think Race was in love with Anne. The way he said those last words made me feel sure of it. She's gone to Barra, he continued rather hastily. Indeed, I said, staring. How do you know? She wrote to me from Bulawayo, telling me she was going home that way. The best thing she can do, poor child. Somehow I don't fancy she's in Barra, I said meditatively. She was just starting when she wrote. I was puzzled. Somebody was clearly lying. Without stopping to reflect that Anne might have excellent reasons for her misleading statements, I gave myself up to the pleasure of scoring off Race. He's always so cocksure. I took the telegram from my pocket and handed it to him. Then how do you explain this? I asked nonchalantly. He seemed dumbfounded. She said she was just starting for Barra, he said in a dazed voice. I know that Race is supposed to be clever. He is, in my opinion, rather a stupid man. It never seemed to occur to him that girls do not always tell the truth. Kimberly, too. What are they doing there? He muttered. Yes, that surprised me. I should have thought Miss Anne would have been in the thick of it here, gathering copy for the daily budget. Kimberly, he said again. The place seemed to upset him. There's nothing to see there. The pits aren't being worked. You know what women are, I said vaguely. He shook his head and went off. I have evidently given him something to think about. No sooner had he departed than my government official reappeared. I hope you'll forgive me for troubling you again, Sir Eustace, he apologized, but there are one or two questions I should like to ask you. Certainly, my dear fellow, I said cheerfully. Ask away. It concerns your secretary. I know nothing about him, I said hastily. He foisted himself upon me in London, robbed me of valuable papers, for which I shall be hauled over the coals, and disappeared like a conjuring trick at Cape Town. It's true that I was at the Falls at the same time as he was, but I was at the hotel, and he was on an island. I can assure you that I never set eyes upon him the whole time I was there. I paused for breath. You misunderstand me. It was of your other secretary that I spoke. What, Paget? I cried, in lively astonishment. He's been with me 8 years, a most trustworthy fellow. My interlocutor smiled. We are still at cross purposes. I refer to the lady. Miss Pettigrew? I exclaimed. Yes. She's been seen coming out of Agrisato's native curio shop. God bless my soul, I interrupted. I was going into that place myself this afternoon. You might have caught me coming out. There doesn't seem to be any innocent thing that one can do in Joburg without being suspected for it. Ah, but she's been there more than once, and in rather doubtful circumstances. I may as well tell you, in confidence, Sir Eustace, that the place is suspected of being a well-known rendezvous used by the secret organization behind this revolution. That's why I should be glad to hear all that you can tell me about this lady. Where and how did you come to engage her? She was lent to me, I replied coldly, by your own government. He collapsed utterly.